You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and you can go to SohoTheatre.com and enter the discount code FAFF, that's F-A-F-F, to get 25% off your tickets to see Dave Gorman on the Comedian's Comedian Podcast live at Soho on Monday, the 7th of March. You can do the same if you'd like to come and see Romesh Ranganathan, and interviewed by myself also, at Soho Theatre on the 4th of April. Get your homework done now, watch all their stuff that's available online, and come and see those guys. Enter FAFF to get 25% off your tickets. Now, though, in an episode recorded live on Bob's Blunderbuss as part of Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival just recently, this is Spencer Jones. Thank you to everyone who came along to this recording, especially Raffle Monk, who very kindly held my pint. Spencer Jones is a prop comic clown idiot dickhead guy who took Edinburgh by storm this year just gone. With his show Proper Job. So check him out if you can see any bits or bobs online. But of course, do try and see him live. Here is Spencer Jones.
I mostly had to restart that because I realised I was talking and hadn't let my guest get a word in edgeways. This is Spencer. Thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thank you for having me. Yay. Very nice to be here.
Now, let's start with, there is loads and loads to talk about because you are someone who I only became aware of this year. Mm. Although, no, and well, I thought I'd only become aware of you this year. And then someone mentioned to me earlier on that you were in Big Babies and that you created Big Babies and wrote it and were in it. And yeah. I suddenly went, that's where I know his face from. He's a big baby in a pram.
That's why you were being friendly. That's why you were like,
So when I met you, I was like, oh, right, I know this guy. And, you know.
Nobody ever came. I've never had anyone come up to me at all after making that show.
Really?
No, because obviously my head was on a baby's body.
So during the show.
Yeah, during the show, yeah. Yeah. So no one ever did. No one ever sort of noticed me or anything like that. So yeah, it was nice.
So give us a bit of a timeline before we talk about the clowning stuff that I'm really excited about talking about. Yeah. That made it sound like, let's talk about the boring stuff.
Yeah.
Let's give us a bit of a timeline of how you got to do Big Babies. Were you performing live before you did that?
Bits and pieces. I was doing a little bit of stand-up, really crap stand-up. And actually, you know, like talking about relationships and stuff, you know,
trad
yeah.
alternative,
yeah. Get off the bus and all that,
yeah.
And I'd been, my girlfriend had finished with me and I was heartbroken. And my mate John Reish, who is a director for commercials, said, "Can you cry on cue?" And I said, "Absolutely, mate."
At the time,
I'm
yes.
your guy. I literally am crying all the time. No problem. What do you need? And so we made this little short video of me crying in places where you'd normally be happy, like so feeding the ducks, just bawling my eyes out, eating a massive lolly, bawling my eyes out. And so he's like a montage of just this guy. And anyway, on the day, I couldn't actually cry. So I end up just pulling a really horrible face, you know, like that really ugly face you do in the mirror when you're really, really upset, you know. And we did that, and we made that, and people kind of liked it. And I liked messing around doing stuff with John. And so we made a few other bits and pieces, like online, really awful. You should search them out. They are, you know, we made some bad stuff. But
and were you making it for a particular client of his, or
just
making stuff?
No, we were just making stuff. He was like, he was a music video director and commercials director. He just split up as a partner. He was in a partnership. And we just sort of decided to make stuff together because everyone can get hold of a camera and, you know, edit it together. And so we just saw that as a nice way of doing stuff to get some, you know, get some stuff out there.
Okay.
And we made a couple of bits. And then for a laugh, we did a little 40-second clip of two babies. We filmed two babies just on a sofa. Then we got a big Sabutio tablecloth and we green screened very roughly our heads onto them. And it was just a 40-second clip of us slagging off children's programmes. And we slagged off a couple of kids' programmes that were on BBC. And someone at the BBC played them in the BBC.
Okay.
And then the BBC phone up said, all right, then, do you want to come in for a meeting?
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And so we kind of made some little bits and pieces with them. And then someone said, do you want to make some 4 or 5 shorts? We costed it up. We said, it's going to cost this much. Quite, you know, time consuming. And they said, oh, with that much money, you might as well make a pilot. So we said, okay. And they said, well, we'll get someone else to write it. And we went, no, we'll write it. And we'd done nothing, really, to be honest. But you know that kind of bit in Rocky where he gets a chance and you just go, this is our Rocky moment. This is our one-off chance. So we just busted our balls every day, like wake up really early and working. Got this pilot, did it. And then it got commissioned. I think the lady who commissioned it, it was her sort of leaving. She was leaving the BBC and she had a bit of money left over. She gave it to us.
Anyone listening at home, it is really as easy as that. You need to piss about with a mate, slag off the BBC and then find a commissioner who's about to leave.
Yeah, yeah. so we kind of made it. We made it, put some mates in it and stuff and, just worked hard and... It felt like a fluke, but I suppose you kind of put yourself out there in whatever job you do and you kind of things start to happen.
And who were you at the time before you were doing this? What were you working as? Had you done any kind of performing before?
Yeah, I've always I've done all sorts of stuff. Like I've been like, what have I done? I kind of fannied around. You know, you get lost in life. You're kind of like, what am I doing? And I'd worked in production as a runner and I'd worked my way up to a producer, but I was never really happy.
Hang on, this is a ringer here.
Oh.
Sorry, you were a TV producer before you started.
No. I was.
You know, you're fanny around producing telly. You know.
No. Do you know what I used to do? I was a producer of music based commercials. So Out and Out, HMV, you know, all that kind of stuff, okay. You know? So you'd get like you get the call from someone, they'd say, we want to put Nirvana's, you know, greatest hits, and so you get a voiceover and blah, 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 and graphics and that kind of thing. And that's how I was doing that, and that's how I met John. So that was all before that. But previous to that, I've worked in a foam factory, actually cutting up foam, got sacked.
Okay. For why?
I don't think I was quick enough. I wasn't a quick enough cutter of foam. I'd always wanted it. There's always this thing, like at school, I was acting was the thing. You know, at school, you'd watch kind of like Harry Enfield and stuff, and you'd do it in the playground afterwards and, you know, the following day. And when I was 30, I just went, I've got to give this acting thing a go, because I'd worked in bars, I'd done all sorts. And the reason I went and got a job as a runner and ended up being a producer was I just wanted to be an actor. And I kept trying to get in, you know, because I didn't go to drama school. I kind of worked it in that way. And so at 30, I went, no, let's give this a proper go. Started making stuff with John, little vids here and there. And then the lucky break came with Big Babies. And then I thought, I've cracked it. And I hadn't. They didn't. They didn't recommission it.
BAFTA nominated that.
BAFTA nominated. Must have been a weak year. So, you know, I kind of... started again, really, you know, started sort of, you know, messing around with stuff and did a sketch troupe, Broken Biscuit, started with me and John. We had a few mates, one mate that I met at a festival, who was a very funny guy, and another bloke I met at a party who did some funny things with an ironing board and had everyone in the room laughing. I went, he's my guy. He put him in the show.
Putting a team together.
Yeah. Exactly. It was like, yeah, who can we get who's least suitable for this job? Yeah, he's my guy.
Okay. So, and what did Broken Biscuits do? Were you doing live stuff or just TV stuff?
Broken Biscuits is the name me and John gave ourselves. Mm-hmm. Then live, we got Broken Biscuits. We got a few more people in and started doing bits and pieces live, sort of sketches and stuff.
And like on the circuit in London?
Small places like rooms above pubs. And we did a few little bits and pieces like for Knock Two Bag. We did a BBC Comedy Presents, a chap there. Saw us and got us up, and that was a real lucky kind of, you know, we did like a little show there. But, you know, not really anything. We sort of, you know, fannied around and stuff, and we didn't, we did. It didn't work. It didn't work in the end. You know, we're all still mates and stuff, but it didn't work out. And then you kind of go, right, I'm going to do character stuff now.
Okay, having so that's the kind of the root of. I feel like I've heard. I can't name anyone off the top of my head, but I feel like that is a fairly well trodden path of yeah. like we'll do a thing together. Oh, it's not really working. Yeah, maybe yeah. I'll just keep trying.
Yeah.
What happened to the other Broken Biscuits people? Did they splinter and do stuff, or was it you that had the mission to?
Well, no, because there was Matt Steer. He's a proper actor, and he's acting and doing all sorts of good stuff. I think he just did Hamlet with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Okay.
At the National.
Oh, so you're the loser from the group?
Yeah. I think I am. Another one was Martin Collins, another great actor and comedian who now does This Glorious Monster.
Okay.
And my mate Dan Kerwin, who was the Gonch, who's doing stuff. But yeah, everyone kind of went off and did their own thing.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk then about the beginnings of doing your own thing. Because right. your show at Edinburgh this year, The Herbert in Proper Job, that's the correct title is Spencer Jones is The Herbert in...
Spencer Jones presents The Herbert in Proper Job.
In Proper Job, okay.
That's what happens when a guy can't work out whether he should call himself Spencer Jones or The Herbert.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier on. That must be difficult because you want to be uniquely Googleable. You want to have a brand, an identity.
Yeah, yeah. And Bob Slayer said, you've got to have your name in it. Got to have your name in it, so yeah. Okay.
Well, it's like me in posters, got to have your face.
Yeah, yeah.
Got a lovely picture of myself, but my face isn't in it.
Yeah.
Got to have your face in it. So you've got to pay attention to marketing wizards along the way, I think. The show that you did at Edinburgh this year was your second show as The Herbert.
Yeah, it was.
Because when I saw the show in the Hive, Heroes of Fringe, I have never, I don't think, in 20-something years of seeing shows, I don't think I've ever seen anyone get as many laughs by just walking on stage and smiling at us. Like, I felt, and there was such a feeling in the room. I don't know if this is something that happened night after night from the reviews and the sort of the momentum that you've gathered since then. Maybe it is. But you walked on, and the buzz in the room from everyone went, oh, this is going to be brilliant.
Oh, that's nice.
So how long has it taken you, and what work have you done to get to that point? Let's talk about the beginnings of The Herbert.
Well, I did a clown course.
Gollier.
No, this is the thing. Everyone says I did 5 days with Gollier.
Okay.
He came to Manchester.
I'm reading this from your press release.
The best, basically, the press release was to get people in. Right? And then, I've done Gollier. No. Okay. I'm not one of those guys who did 3 or 4 months or anything like that. I did a course with Dr. Brown. I don't know why I did it. I just turned up and I did it. And I was absolutely awful, absolutely dreadful. But what I kind of got out of it on the first week was... You know, like when you go to a gig, say you're a comedian, you go to a gig, there's 5 other acts on, say. You might see those 5 acts walk on. Say if you're the compere, you might see all of them walk on. You might see them walk on. And when you first see someone, you make up a little, there's a thing that clicks off in your mind. And if they're a stand-up comedian, their first joke is a big moment. Get the joke right. Oh, we're in safe hands, off we go. But in the workshops, one thing I noticed was, if you've got 30 people in a workshop, they might go on stage within the workshop 5 times. Now, the maths on that is 150 entrances you might see in a day. So John gets up, walks on stage. Oh, John looks like he knows what he's doing. You know, then Catherine gets up. Oh, she looks a little bit meek. You know, and so I love the idea of the magic is in the audience's head for me when you walk on stage. So you've got to work out what it is about you that people see and play with it, you know. So someone will walk on stage and they look like, oh, he looks like he used to be a dancer. Like, if you could do it now, you can see people, try it when you leave. When you're walking along the street, pick someone walking towards you and you'll see there's an air about them as they walk past. If you're with 2 of you, what you can do is look at each other afterwards and do the face they do. and everyone's got something about them, haven't they? Everyone's got something. So what I learned on that is you've got to have the sparkle in your eye. Gollier, one of the few things was you've got to have this little spark in your eye, which is, I really want to be here. This is, I want to be on stage. You could be a real miserable comic, but you've got to be like, but I'm glad I'm here. Yeah. You know, I could be a real happy comic. I'm glad I'm here. You know, I'm not sure about myself, a bit shy, but I'm really glad I'm here.
Okay.
And so those entrances, for me, that moment is, as an audience member, you've paid your money, you work a job, you come, you go, right, let's sit down and have a nice time. And you've got to sort of play up to that. And Gollier, I learned on that week was, people like me when I smile. So make sure you're always smiling.
Yeah. Well, this was going to be my next question. Was you, I mean, you have an enormous twinkle. You're twinkling now. You know what I mean? Yeah, I think you'll agree. There's a lot of twinkle going on here. So is the twinkle something you discovered or something you realised you have to keep doing? Do you, like, before you go on, if you're in a shit mood and you've got to do a gig, are you thinking, well, I better get my twinkle back? Or are you just actually, is it an honest reflection of how much you're enjoying being there?
I'm genuinely happy to be there. Like, if before I go on stage, if you've got to turn it on, you've got, how do I explain it? I'm never in a bad mood when I get on. I mean, I'm vomiting, like, massive.
Nerves.
Yeah, vomiting through nerves. And, I'm not told anyone this. It's a bit weird, but I've started talking to my dad before I go on stage. My dad's not with us anymore, and I'm not a spiritual person in any way. I don't think he can hear me or anything like that. But for some reason, he's become this kind of voice of reason before I go on. So I'm vomiting, and then I imagine he's there, and I say, "You're right, Dad?" He goes, "Yep." and then I go, "Any advice?" He goes, and usually he just says, "Just be nice." Okay. Just be nice. He used to say that when he was alive. He used to say, I'm going to do this thing. So just be nice. Just be nice. Just be nice. My dad was an undercover copper, one of the best undercover coppers in the country.
No.
Yeah. Amazing. Like, said some seriously crazy stuff, and he was a bit of a geezer.
Okay.
And he'd go, "Just be nice." So it's not like.
Oh!
It's, so that's
was
what I
your
say.
Dad Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse?
So yeah, so I kind of, before I go on, I kind of go, okay, be nice. I mean, I'm chuffed. Like, people have come to see me, and. I think part of the reason I vomit is I try and make myself... The audience is the most important thing. They're the most important thing in the room. If I think at any point I'm better than the audience or even equal to the audience, then the fun's over.
That's a really interesting sentiment. Is that something you've discovered, or is that Golier or Dr. Brown talking?
It's about being sensitive, yeah. Like, that was from those little workshops. Mm. What I do on stage is very simple. The rules behind what I do is... The audience are most important. Always check in with them. You're the most important guys. Are you okay? And I'm looking in your eyes now. I'm just checking that everyone's okay. This is me doing it. Are you right? Yeah, everyone's looking. Yeah, all right. Yeah, all right. Everyone's okay. Okay, you're happy. You're happy for me to go and do this. I'm now grabbing something. I'm showing it to you. I just held up my hand for the listeners, but I like that. Oh, and then I've wiggled it, and you go, oh, they like that. They don't like that anymore. I'll take that away. So it's kind of, it's just about let them let you know, and that's basic, kind of very basic. Smile and let them be your guide, kind of thing.
And when you say that Golier was really difficult, those 5 days, did you find them difficult? The Dr. Brown.
Dr. Brown was difficult. Yeah, really difficult, awful the whole week, absolutely awful.
Because it's just people dying, yeah, dying constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I did a couple of Saturdays or a couple of weekends with Dr. Brown. I'd done loads of clown training before in my other life.
Right.
And was always dreadful at it. I just couldn't own it. And I realised later that I think my problem was I couldn't take responsibility for it being shit. I felt personally bad that it was dying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was too in the shit to be able to have the optimism back in me to go, hey,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
I had such a difficulty finding it. When it was hard doing the Dr. Brown course, did you have like a breakthrough moment where it came together?
The breakthrough moment was seeing different people come out and work out what it was about them. There was one guy called Adam who they called him Teflon Man, because when he came out, he just looked like he was solid. Just a nice guy, but he looked solid. So that was a moment working out those things. But the moment for me was that on the last day, basically did this game where you look at the audience and you start to, like, oh, it looks like they might like me bending my legs, so I'll slowly bend my legs. Oh, they like bending my legs, so I'm going to keep bending my legs. And then I ended up on the ground dragging myself along by my ass, going, ah! And people laugh more at that than they've laughed at anything I've ever written. So I kind of went, I think this is it. This is... If I can try and do this, then this is the thing I want to do.
And what was the journey then from that moment to working with props? If I've jumped ahead, go on. Just to take,
well,
take
I'd say, so I start. So I thought, well, I'm going to invent a character called, I was going to be called the Dickhead. But a lot of my northern mates said dickhead's pretty strong, actually. They said dickhead. If he's a dickhead, it's like, oh.
It's a bit mean.
It's a bit mean. But yeah. To me, a dickhead, he's a right dickhead.
Sure.
Yeah, so I thought, we'll go with something else. And I thought the Herbert. So the first gig, I went on as myself and said, I've got a guy I want you to meet. I'm going to go and get him. And I said, just play the track. And someone played a song. And I walked off and quickly put on my, you know, some crap clothes and came out and did the Herbert. And I died on my ass. Like, people were like, what is this? It's just you again being a prick.
Like, you should call it the dickhead. Yeah, like, yeah.
Yeah. And so I kind of went home and I was like, okay, I know it kind of works. I'm sure it will work. So what was wrong with it? Well, and so I thought, well, they saw me before. So I got rid of Spencer. And okay. I just went on the next kid. I went on to the Herbert. And then it worked. It kind of worked a little bit, you know. And I did it like 4 minutes. So I thought, well, let's book some gigs. So I booked a load of gigs, you know, phoned up, email, Facebook. And then the gigs come up. And you're like, oh, shit, I've got a gig. What am I going to do at the gig? And so I'd take a few bits with me, props. You know, I go, well, that's kind of funny. I think what was one of the first things I did? I'd get a glass, a pint glass. And that was it. I'd get a microphone. And I go, this is ridiculous. So you go, singing quietly.
Singing loudly.
And so it's like the idea of, you know, what they do on X Factor. When they do a big note, they pull that microphone away from their face. So I did stuff like that. And there was a thing with the towel where, you know, where you get the spoon. Ooh, you know that thing? And so I did stuff like that. And so just slowly built on that then, you know, if that answers the question.
Yeah, I think so. I'm wondering, just that moment of you coming out, when you came out and announced the Herbert as yourself, whether that, I suppose my guess is that didn't work because they can't then believe in the silliness of the Herbert because they've seen the real you.
Exactly, yeah. They've seen the real you. So they needed me to come out and be that guy.
Okay.
So then it was about thinking, going back to that thing I was saying about the first image. So I had some white tights lying around.
And some spare foam from the foam cutting days.
Yes, yeah. So, the jacket was from a job. The budgie top was from getting drunk on the internet and buying it. Because I did have two budgies. I've got a budgie. The tights were from a Red Bastard workshop that I didn't get up in time to go to.
Okay.
So I had those. So
like
I thought,
a
I've got
kind a... of Buffon clown. Yeah. The Red Bastard is like some scary dark clown.
Exactly. Yeah. What I'd love to have done. And one of the things said, bring white clothing with white tights. And I think they were going to stuff some in stuff inside them. So I had those. And then they had these crazy shoes. And I wanted people to laugh at me instantly. So the tights, you know, you can see my winkle. That's always going to get a laugh, you know.
You've got the twinkle, you've got the winkle.
Yeah. and I just kind of, you look at yourself in the mirror before you go on, you go, okay, you can see my dick a bit, my shoulders. And then I rolled up an Evening Standard that was lying backstage and put it in my shoulders. And then I thought, well, that looks funny. That's kind of stupid. Comb my hair down because, you know, that's another funny thing.
Yeah.
And then just walked on stage with the, you know, desperately thinking, please fucking, please laugh at this.
So this is Spencer, and he is another one of those fabulous comedians who just fills me with warmth and joy. And I don't just mean his act. He's an incredibly lovely man, as you can hear, and very humble. Like a lot of people I find, I often say to people after the podcast, when I've interviewed them, they panic. And my guest says to me afterwards, oh God, did I sound like a complete asshole? And I always say, hey, all the classiest people ask that, and Spencer really thought he sounded like an arsehole. I'm sure you'll agree with me that he doesn't at all. And there's more great stuff to come from him, so we'll launch straight back in just a moment. A couple of notices. Now, listen, I'll talk to you more in the ramble at the end, but I just wanted to say, if you did listen to the ramble from last week or the week before's episode, then you will have heard me talk about the fact that we are calling my baby, my new boy child, Boutros, as code. Well, it's kind of a fun pet name around the house, but kind of code for, I'm not going to tell you what my boy's name is on the podcast, just to try and afford him a little bit of privacy. Some days later, the second most famous Boutros in the world, of course, former UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, kicks the bucket. Our thoughts are with his family at this difficult time. I couldn't believe it. I mean, how many Boutrosses, how many times do you hear the word Boutros? Probably by the end of this show, far more than you have recently. So anyway, I just wanted people to know that this was by no means an insult to Mr. Ghali. Mr. Boutros Ghali, as the surname is very difficult to work out. By no means did we mean to make light of a celebrity death that hadn't happened yet. So that's purely coincidental. I also wanted to say hello to Billy Patterson in Dallas, Texas, and his warehouse full of chumps that may possibly be listening to this. So I've got a lovely email from Texas. Great to hear from Americans. So thanks for listening, and work harder in your warehouse. God knows what you do. On the basis of all the TV based in America that I've seen, you probably make meth. No Podmin on this episode, no log, because I did it myself. Yeah, I sometimes get things done. Thank you to everyone, as I said, that came along at Leicester. And thank you, some people gave me donations there, which were very kind of you. And also, a listener called Duncan emailed me recently and gave me a very pleasant donation, very grateful to him. But he suggested, do you remember on a previous episode, I said something about giving me a donation that would be like a means of working out what would be appropriate for you personally, to donate to the show if you're enjoying it and you'd like to support it. And I suggested a bottle of wine. That was the suggestion of my long-term comedy confidant, Pete Dobbing. He suggested why not pay what you'd spend on a bottle of wine? That way, you know, a rich person who might want to donate a lot to the show might give me 20 or 30 quid, and an impoverished student might give me £1, such as they could purchase a bottle of what my friend Ollie used to call Jack the Bastard's Crazy White Lightning Juice. So by all means, do that. However, Duncan said, and his donation was in line with this, so thanks, Duncan. He said, I've given you what I'd spend on a friend's new baby, which is really sweet, very timely, and much appreciated. So thank you, Duncan, and to everyone else that's donated for the show. A little quick thing I wanted to say about Leicester is hi to Alfie, who couldn't make my preview. I'll talk a bit more about the preview in the ramble at the end. But thank you to Alfie. Your dad came along, and I know you couldn't come to that preview because there was an age limit, I think, which I don't know if I intended to put, so many apologies. This show, where the preview, once probably it's sensible to have an age limit on a preview because I don't know what I'm going to say. But I believe Alfie has come along to the tour show in Leicester at the Cookie sometime in April. So it would be lovely to see you then. Stick around and say hi. And remember, if you're coming to see any of the tour shows, do remember that you can stick around for 5 or 10 minutes afterwards, and we'll have a little off-the-record ComCom Q&A for as long as it takes before we get kicked out of the theatre. If you fancy coming along to one of the tour shows and you live in Birmingham, near the Glee Club, for example, Just the Tonic in Nottingham, Outside the Box in Kingston, the Old Fire Station Windsor, the Hawth Theatre Crawley, XS Malarkey Manchester, the Wardrobe in Bristol, Joker Comedy Club in Southend, the Gulbenkian in Canterbury, West End Centre in Aldershot, the Old Town Hall in Hemel, the Stables in Milton Keynes, the Ring of Bells in Bath, the Bicycle Shop in Norwich, the Cookie Jar in Leicester, the Royal and Durngate Northampton, the Arena Theatre Wolverhampton, Soho Theatre in London, Laughing Coyote at Sutton Theatres, or indeed the Secret Welsh Festival, about which we are not allowed to talk, then please come along. I would love to see you at the show. And what I hope for is at least a 50-50 ratio of you guys from the podcast who know me and know what's going on in my life, and strangers that we wish to convert. So your support is very much appreciated. And thanks for those of you who've been getting in touch to tell me you're coming to the show. It's enormously encouraging. Now, I'll be back after the conclusion of the podcast to waffle at you at length. But for now, thanks for listening. Thanks for donating to the show, sharing it to people, putting nice reviews on iTunes and all over the shop. You can tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to get in touch. And I'd like you all to be aware that I am now even less good at getting back to you now that I have a tiny boy child. This is the remains of Spencer Jones.
So given that you're, and I know it's your second hour, I didn't see the first one.
Yeah.
But the, like, I assume the first one was similar in that it was a collection of tiny little gags and silly ideas. And I suppose what I'm asking is the show, when you do an hour, is that a collage of all of the dicking about that you've been doing?
Yeah, I reckon the first show had bits of all previous stuff. You know, there was like At the time, my home life was a building site. I was living on a building site. So I had lots of like builder stuff around. Didn't have any money, so I nicked bits and pieces that were lying around the house and took that up to the show in Edinburgh. And I had an idea for a story for that. And I learned a lot on that. And then the second, it was awful, that first day.
Okay. The first day of doing the hour in Edinburgh.
First day of doing the hour in Edinburgh was one of the worst things that's ever happened to me, yeah.
Because,
well, on the train, we're all dreamers. Like, comedians are dreamers. They're like, okay, this is going to be amazing. I'm going to be a star. And you kind of like, you go, oh, this is going to be amazing. It's going to be, this is good. I've got to start, a middle and end. It's going to be great. And then you get to the venue, Bob's lovely venue at the Hive, the big room, 3:30 in the afternoon. How many chairs do you want to put out? Put them all out, mate. Put them all out. I've done Gollier, mate. Put them all out. Yeah, 80 chairs, 3 people. Yeah. 6 rows back. 2 Spanish people, didn't understand a word of it. And this kind of 60-year-old Scottish rambler still all in his sort of, you know, with his rucksack on. And, you know, like, you walk on stage, you're like, well, I've got a game plan and I've got to stick to it. And it was just awful. Like, I remember sitting down afterwards. It was just awful. Then 6 rows back, you know, and what the hell am I doing? And then I sat down on the pavement afterwards. My mate Polly had a fag. And then the next day I said, okay, let's have them sitting on the front row. And then the next day there were 7 people. And I counted them just to make a point of being like, I know there's 7 of you in this massive room. So I went 1, 2, 3 and counted them out. And that was a moment, a little thing, you know. And then at the end of that Edinburgh, after it being tough and stuff, you kind of become a bit harder and stuff. And that was more of a story. Then this year was, okay, gig the shit out of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I've sworn already now.
You can swear on the podcast.
Gig, you know, go do as many gigs as you can. Gig. Try out these little pieces, these little sort of like pieces of the puzzle and get them good and then try and find a show out of it.
Yes, because so there was almost like an emotional or sort of narrative plot.
Yeah.
Holding them together, holding proper job together, which was about your son having the head of a fox.
Yeah.
And being radioactive.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All based on truth.
Yeah. And that reminds me of another question, which is that you incorporate your home life and your children into elements of your work. And I'm thinking of not just the album that you would like a CD, which I actually really enjoy.
Cheers,
yeah, I love it.
A bit repetitive though, isn't it?
Yeah, here and there. I mean, I would say there's three standout tracks.
Yeah,
really.
Okay.
And I remember buying it off you after the gig and sort of expanding your the income from the show, flogging these kind of things that you'd folded into bits of paper. Yeah. Like really charmingly crap. Yeah. Much like the oeuvre.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, in the best way. Do you mean that's the aesthetic, rolled up Evening Standard, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I remember when you sold it to me, you were like, it's a load of bollocks. And I took it home. You were absolutely right, but really good. But so you're using samples and loops of your children in some of them. And I noticed one of your, it's not quite like a proper promo photo, but it's like on Facebook for a preview you were doing. It's a picture of you on a swing at the park pulling a stupid face.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little kid in the background.
Yeah.
And it did, as a recent new father, it did make me go, oh yeah, this, because they're there, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're there. And you've managed, like what a lot of comedians can do is kind of go, right, now daddy's in the office or mummy's in the office, I'm working, and maybe I'm writing jokes about the kids.
Yeah.
But I found it really charming that you were sort of there. I feel like we get a lot of you, apart from the Herbert.
Yeah.
We get a lot of you. I enjoy seeing through it and going, oh, this must be what he's like as a person. This must be what his life is like, what his home life is like.
Yeah, it's a funny one because I think one of the reasons I wasn't a very good stand-up is I'm quite private.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to let people know about what's going on up here in that way. But then doing all this, I ended up probably showing much more than I ever would have as a stand-up, you know, having the kid and all those kind of worries and stuff. And having Littlen in the house, it's hilarious because he's like a comedian, but without any rules. It's like he's the best new comedian ever, you know. there's a bit, you know, I've got this bit where I'm in a nuclear power plant and I've got this little yellow box that makes the noise, right? It's called a chaos oscillator 2 or something like that. And I did 3 or 4 hours on this thing trying to get something funny out of it. And all I got was just this dirge sort of house music. And I was furious. I have a cup of tea. And then in walks Sonny you know, massive head, little arms. You know, like kids are all out of proportion. And he walks in, he just picks it up, puts it up to his head and goes, hello? And his cheek touched the pad and the pad went warm. It was... And I went, of course, of course. And that was it, totally. That was him. He got that. That was his yes. thing. And so then you're like, of course it can be something else. It doesn't have to make yes. music.
That's beautiful. That kind of the link between a sort of a childlike... I remember from clown courses, like you try and approach yourself and the world and your body as if it's new.
Yeah.
As if you're a baby again. Yeah. As if you're a child sort of exploring yeah. and discovering things.
It's beautiful. He's got a great head. He's got a great head. The grown tube bit is him as well. Had two of them.
Oh, yeah.
and he's drumming with them.
Yeah, so grown tubes, just for people who can't see the mime, those like tubes.
A plastic tube with a little, what would be like a wazzle inside. So it's like a reed which moves up and down when you turn it upside down. He's whacking the hell out of these things. One of the ends comes off without me realising. He puts the inside bit, the bit that moves, in his mouth. And he's walking around going... And you just go, give me that, mate. Do you know what I mean? That's next month's rent.
Yeah.
And so it's brilliant. He's the man. He's the man when it comes to that kind of thing.
When you say, you mentioned earlier on playing with this K-Oscillator, I'd done 2 or 3 hours on it, you said, and couldn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
So is that, are we imagining a kind of a working environment for you where you go, right, I've got to make some stuff, and you're picking up a thing and doing a couple of hours on it?
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Well, it used to be, before kids, I'd used to sort of wander around and mess around stuff, and you know, you'd be unfocused and stuff. and then I found with the kids, you just don't have the time. They're like, they're always in the way and stuff. And I said to my friend Lucy, who's is a clown, she trained at Gollier.
We'll talk about it.
Amazing. Yeah. And she said, well, what you need to do is, now you've got to change the way you work. So grab an hour every day. And what I do is I dance around like a dick for like 20 minutes to whatever music, you know, I like, you know, stupid stuff. At the minute, it's like Rage Against the Machine, which is ridiculous, but get the camera set up, dance around like a dick for 20 minutes, get yourself really sort of pumped and stuff and just stupid, forget about all the, you know, and then press record on the camera, pick up a prop and do 20 minutes with it, in character, without breaking. So, for example, one of the rubber gloves, okay? There's only so many things you can do with a rubber glove. And after about three or four... Well, actually, that sounds really weird. And so you kind of mess around with the rubber glove, stay in character. And after, like, literally, like, 14 minutes, something weird happens where you start doing stuff you'd never do with it. And then after 20 minutes, you stop, and then you move on to the next prop. So this goes on for you do an hour. Say you do an hour. And then you watch it back, and it's the worst thing to watch. It's like, this is awful. But at about 14 minutes in, you go, ooh, that's something. When you've given up, when you're just a stupid, like, broken twat sat in your bedroom, or, well, in my workroom, something happens. So that's one way of working. Another, obviously, there's all sorts of different ways. You know, sometimes Sunny comes up with something, but I have a workroom with a huge mirror and...
Okay.
And shelves of stuff and, yeah.
That seems like an incredibly... I'm really surprised by how organised a system of working that is.
That is one of the ways. Yeah, that's one of the ways to do it.
And that's sort of... It's almost like that's the clown equivalent of morning pages or something. Where,
exactly.
You know, when you're just writing and writing. And I always find whenever... If I sit down and write for 2 hours... The first hour is always absolute dross, and I'm on the verge of giving up and go, what's the point? Why did I ever think I could ever write a joke?
Yeah.
I'm going home. And then you've got to push, and then you go, oh, hang on, maybe there's a something there. But it never happens until you've pushed through the awful bit.
Yeah. You just reset. You just sort of, you do all the normal stuff. It's weird. It's a weird way of working. It's horrible. But
what's Lucy's surname?
Hopkins,
that's it. I met Lucy in Australia. She was doing a brilliant clown show with a scarf.
Le Foulard?
It's Le Foulard. Man. I just wanted to mention that because I saw it and I was raving to everyone about it at the time. It's such an incredible show.
Yeah, she's class. She's absolute class.
And where did you know Lucy from? Was that from your 5 days in Gollier?
No. At the end of doing the Dr. Brown, everyone said, oh, we're going to see this show. And she was doing a show, and a guy called Carlo...
Okay.
I forgot his surname, was doing a show. So she did her show and he did his. And they were like, you know, This was this, when you went there. You were like, "This is what you could be like if you're if you work hard at this.
If you can suffer enough."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about suffering in the context of clowning. And do you regard the work you do as clowning? Do you call it?
I've got a clue.
Okay,
I just trying to make people laugh. I can do characters. I can do sort of. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I do. I'm a prop comic by definition because I take props in. I probably think like a clown. I can do voices. I don't know what I'm doing. All I know is if I don't do it, I turn into a real miserable git.
The thing they used to say at clown school, do less, suffer more. And that's like a big principle of it. Don't be doing all this stuff. Just suffer. We just want to see you suffer.
Yeah.
And it's saying that now. It sounds sort of awful and sadistic. But I kind of now I feel like I can understand it. Like I was thinking about the short that I've just seen. You did the Sky Christmas short. You did a little 10-minute or 8-minute short film. And the premise is brilliant, which is just in your own words. The premise of the show is what?
Guy, 10 minutes before the shop shut on Christmas Eve, gets all the presents nicked from the car and has to come up with a solution in a hardware shop.
Okay, fine. So, and that is, I have to say, it's one of the most effective, it's one of the most working translations from a live show to a TV format of what it is that you do, because it's so you, and it's not like you dicking around with props, but it contains so many elements. It's got the musical element, and there's the drum kit, the girls play the drums, and you know, your samples are coming into it. There's very little dialogue in it, really. It's much more of it is about the spaces in between the words, and it's about your face, and it's about you suffering. It's about the moments when your wife in the short goes, "You have done that, right?" And you just sort of look up like, yeah. And we can see that you haven't done it, and we can see that you know you haven't done it, and you're in trouble, but you're remaining optimistic.
Yeah.
You've managed to take that clown in a way that I think a lot of comics struggle with, particularly a lot of physical performers, to actually put it on telly and have it still retain the magical quality of the live show.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because that was meant to. My idea behind that was I want to look like a safe pair of hands for the telly people. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wanted, like, okay, we've got half a chance here. It's another rocky moment.
Yeah.
It's done. Everything's gone well in Edinburgh. But I'm going to need... I can't be doing this forever. I need to have other forms of income.
Because presumably, I mean, is there much of a paid circuit for the sort of stuff you do? You're not doing traditional club gigs. You're not going to do a weekend in a commercial club.
I'm still working out whether I can do it or not. It's difficult because you've got all the props and stuff. Yeah, I mean, it works. But... It's about variety for me. I don't know if you're the same, but I kind of like... I get bored. And one of the reasons why I do this job is it's the least boring thing I can think of. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I get really bored and I start being stupid if I'm bored. I've lost my thread now. Sky.
So being able to make money, circuit gigs.
Yeah, I wanted to look like...
What's the next thing? A safe pair of hands, you said.
Yeah, a safe pair of hands, yeah. Like, no one would hire me as an actor. That's why probably one of the reasons why I started doing comedy. So I thought, well, I've got half a chance now to show I can do a bit of acting.
Yeah.
But I wanted it to kind of... Just wanted to put a bloke under pressure, and that's what... And a lot of people don't speak a lot, you know. You know, sit and listen and go, all right, mate, yeah. When someone else is talking away, especially in London, they don't have to talk.
Well, what it gives you, and I don't know if anyone's sort of seen it on Sky or anyone listening to this, I really, really recommend it. I know I'm tired, but I did tear up. I thought it was really beautiful. And one thing that I liked about it was because of your face. I've literally written face and drawn a circle around it in my notes. Because of your face, you have this kind of, and it's easy and probably misleading to liken what you do to say Eric Morecambe or Tommy Cooper or what have you. But the twinkle and the ability to just kind of imply a thing without saying much and just go. That thing that you're so good at doing when you walk on as the Herbert, and you're like,
You
know, whatever that thing is, it has a kind of an archetypal quality. You could be in any place in any time, being the sort of the put upon, you know, the butt of the joke.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I just try and put it for truth. I know that's a real cliche, but we just wanted to put him under pressure. When I walk on stage, I'm under pressure. I just let them know, let people know you're under pressure, but you're really happy with it. We had very good people around me on that, and it's very good. Editing's great. that bit there, yeah, we used that bit there. You know, there's lots of takes and stuff. It was a fast shoot, but there's lots of
takes. Were you in on the edit? Were you editing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was all over it. I wanted to be all over it, but I had a brilliant team and everything.
I remember talking to Phil Ellis about this when they made Funds and Games on TV. They made it as a TV show.
Yeah.
And he fought really hard, he was telling me, to be present at the edit, which isn't how they'd normally do it with telly. They're like, you do the thing, we know about telly, we'll cut it together. And that's always seemed crazy to me, given what the comic knows, what the performer knows about rhythm, that you can so easily kill a joke stone dead by using either the wrong take of it or lingering on the face for too long or not long enough.
I think it's a real dance, actually. When someone's done well on stage, maybe stand-ups and stuff, and then they make the transition, you've really got to redevelop again. I think you've got to go, okay, what I do on stage is great. I think I make people laugh. That's good. This is not me saying. This is like one, not me. Hey, what I do on stage is great.
I'm going to cut everything and just use that sentence.
You've got your idea. You go to the telly people. You've got to be, have some brilliant people you're working with that can say, oh, that will work, that won't work. And it's you've got to develop it. You've got to keep the dance going backwards and forward. So you'll get notes. Say you get 10 notes. Six of them, I agree with them. We'll implement them. Four of them you don't agree with. But how can we change the thing they're talking about so it's better, but we feel like they've had some input? But also the telly people, they will know what they're doing. Some of them will, some of them won't. Same as the, you know, a comedian. Mm. I think you've just got to, I'm getting lost here, but you've just got to keep thinking, is this decent? Get rid of it if it's not, you know, if it's not, get rid of it. Don't be precious about stuff and keep developing it. Even if you think something's brilliant and someone says that's not great, go, okay. Don't go, oh, it is. Go, okay, how can I make it better? Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I think you've just got to keep working. You've got to be, I've got this thing called guffaw factor, right? Which is when people are writing comedy and they're so busy going, oh, at what they're doing, they're not editing it, you know? They're not kind of going, actually, how can that be better? And I think that's one of the things you need to do.
Well, this throws up quite an interesting aspect of you as a performer, and something I think is very unusual for someone who exists within the world of whatever we're going to want to call it, clown or... I mean, this is a way into this part of the conversation. What is your... It's all right. It's a recording. We'll just wait for 2 seconds. Totally fine. No need to try and sneak out. We'll pretend you're not sneaking out. We'll just pause till you get back. No, anyway. Who do you consider to be your contemporaries in terms of the weirdness that you're doing? You know, who's in your gang? Like, if you could say, if I could ask, you know, Jimmy Carr, who are the other one-liner guys? Yep. Okay, Milton Jones, Gary Delaney, people like that.
Yep.
Who are the other sort of dickheads? in the southern sense. In the fluffy southern sense of the word.
In the fluffy southern sense. Who are the dickheads? There's loads. There's the Weirdos crew. I mean, I don't know, there's like loads of them. Like, head up. The Weirdos crew.
That's Adam Larter.
Adam Larter and
Carl Schultz.
And Carl and Ali Bryce and all that lot, you know, and Let Loose. And there's, I mean, loads. So you could, you know, Gareth and... They're mental. So you go and see them and, you know, they're great. Then there's a night at the... there's a night called The Lost Cabaret where, like, you know, it's a small audience, but literally you'll sit there in the audience going, oh, my God, someone's coming on dressed as a mountain. You know, and the act is them trying to get on stage, and it's like by the time they go, and it's brilliant. You kind of go, this is good stuff, you know. So I don't know, contemporaries. Yeah, those guys. There's loads. It's really difficult because I don't know how to answer the question.
What is it that you're nervous about in answering the question? Why is it difficult?
It's difficult to mention everyone. Everyone, there's all sorts of people that what am I? I'm a prop comic. Well, who else uses props? Boy with tape on his face uses props, but he's bigger than me. Dr. Brown, you know, is a clown, but he's bigger than me. These aren't my contemporaries. I think it's the people I gig with, the people I've mentioned, you know,
okay.
Doing gigs with Harry Deansway's, you know, doing, you know, those kind of gigs when you're meeting people. Those are my contemporaries. The people that are out there now,
okay,
doing stupid stuff.
What I'm getting at, I suppose, and that's interesting to kind of that sort of like further reading for listeners, which is great. I suppose what I'm getting at is among the people that do dickheadery or whatever it is, clowning.
I don't
want to call it props. It's not. It doesn't say what the thing is. But what you do is quite rough. Do you know what I mean? Like the feel of it is rough. You've got stuff you've got in a pound shop. You know. And it's kind of deliberately scrappy and charmingly kind of rough and dickheady and stuff like that. Amongst people who do that sort of thing, you seem to be, as you've just described it, you seem to be pretty on it in terms of going, right, I've got to make this work. Here's a rocky moment. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's a confluence in you between cocking about and actually seizing the opportunity and going, I want to actually turn this into something professional,
with
proper production values,
and
things like that. And I suppose I don't know Adam Larson. I've actually never seen him, but I've read something that he wrote, I read him in an interview, I think, where he was saying that part of this groundswell of weirdos, not specifically his group, but that kind of flavour of stuff, is that it exists in a kind of a landscape where you can't make money from comedy anymore. Because the environment in which those comics started working was so oversaturated with comics that becoming someone who can make 50 grand a year from doing the circuit like the olden days, it isn't really possible.
Yeah.
So I'm just interested in knowing whether it seemed to me there was a lot of people kind of rejecting doing it professionally and doing it for the fun of it and, you know, dressing as a mountain trying to get on stage, that weirdness that isn't necessarily commercial.
Yeah.
And with you, it seems like you have all of those interests and all of those skills. But also there's something commercial underpinning you that you're... Or not commercial even, but there's a professionalism.
I think I want to be... I don't want to be a miserable old man when I'm old. And the only way that's going to happen is if I can look back and go, whatever happens, you worked really hard, you had a great time working really hard... And that's all it is to me. That's all I have is I want to make good stuff, people to have a nice time. And then when I'm older, regardless of how it goes, whether I'm, you know, absolutely skint or I've, you know, earned a couple of quid, I can go, that was okay. Because that's my biggest drive, is not turning into a miserable old man. And that sounds really weird, but that's kind of one of the main things is I've got a thing on, I've got a TV at home, right? And I've got a sticker across the top.
Easy there, mate. We've all got a TV, mate.
I've got a TV. I'm on my telly at home. I've got a sticker. I've got a sticker across the top. It's just a bit of masking tape, and I've done it. I've written on it: "Is watching this the best use of your time?" And I kind of think, you know. I love watching telly. I love it. But if I'm watching it and then just above it, it's this thing. Maybe I won't watch this old episode of Bullseye tonight. Do you know? So going back to the answer to the question, I think that what you're seeing, the professionalism or the drive and stuff is that. It's the fear of the old man.
And why, do you have any inkling as to why that is such an important thing? Did you encounter miserable old men? Is there anyone you knew became a miserable old man?
But no,
where have you got that idea from?
My mum often says to me, "Oh, I wish I'd done this, and I wish I'd done that."
Okay.
And I don't want to be thinking like that. I don't want to sort of like, you know, my mum's hilarious and she's done loads of stuff, but she's loads of stuff that she wishes she had done.
Okay.
And I think, we only get one go, you know. So I figured, let's have it, you know. That's my thought on it, is get stuck in, whatever it is you're doing, you know, bike riding, you know, painting, whatever, you know, fighting, just do it. Just do
war.
It. Yeah,
war.
War. Just get stuck in. Yourself off.
Just do it properly.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other things I want to ask you about before we wrap up.
Blimey.
One of them is, when it doesn't work, when in the live shows I'm talking about, the moments when it doesn't catch, when you can't win them over by twinkling, why doesn't it work? When it's gone wrong, what is it that's gone wrong?
Maybe because I've got complacent. I've stopped being sensitive. It's really hard doing this because I've got you here and I'm looking at you, but then I've got you and my instinct is to make sure you guys are all right.
I ignore them.
When it's gone wrong, I'm really, I hate saying it's when it's the audience's fault, even if it, people might think it is. Yeah. No, it's not. It's just, you know, I got complacent, didn't try hard enough. I didn't do it loud enough. I didn't smile enough. When it goes wrong, that's it, you know. Sometimes they couldn't hear you, but it might not be my fault. It might be that there's noise next door or something. But when it doesn't go right, it means you're not good enough.
And can you always hold on to that? Do you have moments? I mean, what are the long, dark moments of the soul for you creatively? Do you have moments when you're like, oh, Christ, what am I doing? Do you,
Oh, my God. I'm having one right now. Yeah, all the time. Yeah, it never goes away. Before, when you're on stage, when you come off stage, when you look at your son and he goes, "Hi, Dad," you go, "Oh my God, I'm not good enough." Yeah, all the time. Yeah, I think I really. It's just a bit where you just realise I'm depressed.
Don't give it away.
Yeah, all the time. All the time. It's a real drive. It's a real. It's probably a bit like unhealthy, but yeah, all the time. After this, I'll be like, I could have answered that better. Probably wasn't holding the mic properly. Probably. Do you know what I mean? I feel like, too far away. Too far away. He's going to get home and edit this, and it's going, oh no. And then I'll be the guy. We had this comedian on called Spencer Jones. Please hold the mic here.
That's the preamble for guests to come.
All the time.
And how do you get yourself out of those moments? How do you cope with it when it's not worked? If you're driving back from a struggler.
Oh, how do I get myself out of it?
Particularly if you are very nobly and very responsibly taking responsibility for the night and not blaming them and going, actually, it was me. Yeah. I wasn't sensitive enough.
Yeah.
Oh, no. God, what am I doing?
Yeah. Just do it better next time. Just got to do it better next time.
And are you able to snap out of it?
I find a six-year-old, like, in your face at 5:30 in the morning will do that. Do you know what I mean? Daddy! Okay, yeah, I'll forget about that now. Yeah, porridge? Yeah. Okay, let's have some porridge, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's watch Peter Rabbit.
I'm 3.5 weeks in and I've already started to recognise an element of that. I'm just going, yeah, I don't care how well that went. I've got other fish to fry.
Yeah, yeah. How has the poo come up and around? Yeah. When do we have this? Who had this? Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just move on. Try not to think about it. I think I'm quite good at, compartmentalising. Yeah. Just put it away in a box somewhere else and worry about it another time.
When you're an old man.
Yeah.
Upset.
I remember a time. I don't know why I'm... I don't know why I'm American
in the
future.
When you're an old American man. No, just... Spencer, to wrap up. Thank you. This has been brilliant. Just to wrap up.
Oh, shit.
There's two...
You go again.
There's a couple of things. What bit of someone else's do you wish that you'd come up with? Do you ever have that? Do you see someone do a thing like either with a prop or some sort of clowny idea that you feel is like, I could have, I should have got that?
No, is there anything? No,
too happy.
No, I'm not. Well, I hadn't really thought about it. Is there something I wish I'd done? No, I think that's bad. I think that's like, that feels like a bad thing to think. I wish I'd thought of that. It's like, well, that's not a nice thing to think, is it? I still like seeing Eric Morecambe slapping Ernie Wise around the face. You know when he does the double tap, ting ting. That always makes me. My son did that to me the other day.
The double tap.
The double tap. Yeah. He did it to me the other day. Son just went, "Daddy." I went, "Yeah." He went, "I love you." Ting ting. stuff my son comes up with. What was it for my son? I tell you what, the stuff my son comes up with. That's my answer. I know that's a real wanky thing to say, but. He goes, right, the other day, I went, "Oh, you've got to have a bath because you're stinky." You've got to have a bath, mate. Anyway, all the way through the day, this is a new word. Stinky. Daddy, you're stinky. Daddy, you stink. Daddy, you're stinky. Yeah. And by the end of the day, he was in the bath. I mean, he went, "Daddy, you're stinky." Still going, "Daddy, you're stinky." I went, "Mate, I've taken you to see animals today. I bought you that football. We've had a nice day. We've had a nice day, haven't we? I mean, you're just saying stinky to me. It's horrible. He went, and his face just changed. It's dropped. He went, oh, daddy. I went, yeah. He went, you're stinky. My son, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mr. Spencer Jones.
Thank you so much to Spencer for coming on the show. Thank you for listening to it, for donating, for sharing it with your friends and even people that you hate in an attempt to convert them. As my friend Ninja Chris used to describe an ancient lost style of kung fu, that as someone attacked you, you could realign their chi such that they stopped being aggressive, and then eventually you have the chance to befriend them. So if you can do that with this podcast, more power to you. Tweet me at ComComPod, email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Anyway, that concludes the podcast. Thanks for listening. Do come and see the tour or the live shows if you fancy. And that is the end of that. Are they gone? No, that's it. It's over. Okay, so I'm just going to have a very quick chat to you today because I've got to go and eat quiche. It's the evening. It's the evening times, and the boy needs a bath. The Boutros has got to be washed. He's reacting very well to baths at the moment. Last two times, he hasn't lost his shit, neither metaphorically nor actually. So I'm just going to very quickly. There's only a couple of things I wanted to say. Really, Leicester was great. The preview. I did a bunch of gigs. Hey, here's a thing. Here's an odd thing to admit to. I made a mistake, I think. I made a tactical mistake at a gig at a comedy festival. Tell me what you think of this. I did newer stuff than I should have done at a sort of big charity gala type gig. And I came away from it thinking, wow, God, I'm just on this, not a treadmill exactly, but we talked about this on the show before, and I try not to feel like this, but I always remain to some extent transfixed, like in the headlights, like a deer in the headlights of Edinburgh, trying to work on new stuff all the time. So rather than, like Hari was saying last week, rather than honing a set for 5 years, what I do, and I think what a lot of us do, is constantly be trying to get the new stuff out there. So when is there an opportunity to do the great stuff from last year or 2 years ago or 3 years ago that you've polished up? Because, I mean, it does, you know, you rely on certain bits in your club set. But when I get to, so it's specifically at this gig, it went absolutely fine. It went fine, but it could really have, I could have walloped it with, it was only a 10-minute set and it was a big show, and there's a lot of people in that city that I want to come and see my tour, and yet for some reason at the time I was exhausted. I'd had an incredibly full weekend of podcasts and gigs and all sorts, and also I'm excited by the new stuff, so I wanted to do the new stuff because I was excited. But I did come away thinking tactically I could probably have got more laughs if I'd gone, wallop, here's a bit of stuff that's 18 months old but is actually still a bit polished up. So I was a bit frustrated with myself for that. I don't know what your experiences are, and I know a lot of you get in touch with me and say, I'm a graphic designer and I have similar things, or I'm a, you know, dental lecturer and I've got to do a thesis and stuff. So I just wonder whether across the board, as creative people, and I hate describing myself, yeah, I'm a creative person, it means I don't have to do real work. Across the board, I wonder if, let's say people who make things, that's equally valid, are we all? Do you have that problem as well, that you're always trying to make the next stuff to go on display so you don't get to enjoy? Like, when do I? You know, there are certain kind of more prestigious gigs or more gigs where the bar is higher or the audience have paid more, or it's a, I wouldn't say corporate necessarily, but there, you know, there are fun kickabout gigs where you go, look, this is 80 quid and it's a room I trust and the promoter trusts me, so I'm going to dick about and probably come out of this experience having done a better show, maybe, but certainly having tried stuff out and played with things and had fun. And then there are gigs where you think, right, I've got to be giving this my absolute best shot to make sure I get rebooked, to, you know, whatever. And I've always wondered whether in my career I've been too focused on playful stuff to I know there are some people, the Sarah Millicans of this world, I remember early days, she would always go, here we go, this is a gig, they've paid the money, here's my absolute A-list stuff. And I've always been, probably because I'm a more chatty, flappy sort of an act, I've always been someone that's gone, no, the act is what I say it is. So whatever I do when I turn up, that's the act. And there's an argument for that as well. Anyway, this is sort of getting off the track. I just wanted to sort of go, oh, yeah, that was an interesting... As long as I learn from that, tactically speaking, I came off thinking I was right to try that stuff, but I could have been righter to do other stuff. So that's that. Anyway, the festival itself at Leicester was brilliant. I had some really good fun. And saw some very good work. Lloyd Griffiths did an absolutely bang-up job as a compere in a gig in which he said from the stage accurately that he said at the end of the show, he said, ladies and gentlemen, every single act that's walked through this door has seen this setup and their heart has sank. I thought it was going to be awful, and it wasn't, because the people at the gig were absolutely brilliant. So we all gave of our best, and that was in large part due to some excellent emceeing. So nice one, Lloyd. Some lovely other gigs up there as well. But the preview. So I've accidentally written 45 minutes about the Boutros. Because it's all I'm bloody thinking about. The baby and my reaction to his existence and how my life is changing and everything else. And the plan is by no means to do a show in Edinburgh that could be summed up with a poster of me with a baby in one hand and a mic in the other going, fleur. I don't plan to do that. But, God, is this the beginning of the end? Is this the thin end of the wedge? Of course I'm going to write jokes about my baby, because he's in my life 25 hours a day. But I don't just want to write a baby show that only baby fans are going to come and see, because, you know, people without babies don't care, and people with babies are sick of babies. So, anyway, I started off, right, we'll do some baby stuff. And I looked at my watch and went, holy shit, 43 minutes has elapsed. I mean, it was funny. And that's the other danger from doing previews, isn't it? You come out thinking, hey, that was good. And you listen back to it and you go, oh, no, the biggest laughs were all the stuff of me kicking my own new material and going, oh, this isn't good enough, and blowing my cheeks out. So it remains to be seen where we are now. But come on, it's only February. I'm sure I've broken the back of the show. I just need, as Alan Cochrane is always fond of saying, as it was then, as if he were dead. Alan will never die. As Alan was fond of saying to me in recent years, I just need another three good big bits. Another three big bits. So it's important to realise that one will always feel like that. So the show is in increasingly good nick. I'm feeling good about the tour, although weirdly I am in this position now where it starts in like 9 days. And I've got to remind myself what the show is, because I've been writing a completely different show now for months. So I hope I can find a recording of the tour show. If I can't find a recording of it, then the tour show will be the show that it was on day one of the Edinburgh Festival, because I've definitely got that recording. But obviously, after a month of knocking it up and down, it got really finessed. So I hope I can remember all the finesse. I'm sure I will. But it's just one of those jobs that you put off, isn't it? Listening to yourself bang on for an hour. And then, of course, around about the same time, you try and sell online, you banging on for an hour. I hope that's not too rude. I often think to myself, look, if I'm expecting people to listen to this, then I've got to be prepared to listen back to it myself and make notes. But, of course, you bastards have only got to hear it once, haven't you? Anyway, that's where I'm at with the tour. That's where I'm at with the show coming up. I won't bore you to tears with any more dad observations, but, God, I mean, you know, it's a bit hard sometimes. And one of the hardest things for men, I guess, is seeing how much harder it is for your partner, because she's, she's, the baby's glued to her via with a traditional mouth boob combo. And so she's having a really tough, she's coping brilliantly. This is my point. She's coping brilliantly and I'm coping less well under easier circumstances. And that's quite tough. I think that's all I've got to talk about today. I should probably throw in something that is neither show nor Boutros related, but it's pretty much all that's on my mind. I made one observation. I don't want it to be a show full of the new one. I don't want it to be a show full of baby observations. But I did notice that mums, this isn't going to work because it's visual, but mums push a pram with two hands and dads push a pram with one hand and one hand on their mobile device. I mean, what kind of a... Yeah, it's probably funny if you see me mime it. Last thing then. It's another dad thing. You see my problem. This is just in the forefront of my mind. I never wanted to be one of those dads who would, or one of those husbands who would pretend to their partner that they'd had less fun when they were out than they'd actually had. But you've got to do it, haven't you? Because you don't want to come back and go, oh, God, you've had an incredibly hard time of it. How was the thing you went to see, Stu? Oh, it was brilliant. I've had a great time. I mean, she's lovely, my partner, and I'm sure she'd want me to do that. But at the same time, I do feel like I need to knock 5% of the sheen off anything I've done. It's that thing when people go, how did you sleep? And you go, yeah, great. Oh, no, I mean, you know, yeah, bad dreams and stuff. Didn't sleep. We woke up a few times. Had to go 3 weeks. You know, it was terrible. Does that satisfy you? you have, not that you need satisfying, but is that okay? Because if I say, I just had an incredible 7 hour sleep, I'm just going to make you sad. So I didn't want to be one of those people, but, you know, there's loads of things I thought I'd never do. And then you suddenly gain an appreciation of the real world circumstances, which cause everyone to behave like that. Best example here is whenever I've seen anyone in an action movie dangling from a rope ladder from a helicopter. Yeah, I mean, that's clear. Why bother explaining that, Stuart? They can infer all they need to. Whenever I see someone dangling from a rope ladder under a helicopter, I always think, you know, and they start to lose their grip and the camera zooms in and the fingers are peeling back one by one. I always think to myself, come on, mate, just hold on. If that was me, I'd just hold on for a bit longer. And then you go, yeah, try dangling from a rope ladder from a helicopter. You might have a slightly more... I can't even be bothered to finish that sentence. My mind's falling apart. The ramble for tonight is concluded. Look, I'll get myself back together in future, I promise. So that'll do me for now. We need to call this a thing, and we need that thing to be a team name or a secret code or a hashtag so that you can let me know you listen. Because so far I've had some lovely comments about it, but I was making the case for doing this to someone recently and I said, yeah, I've had like five people have said, and then I looked at the equivalent numbers of the size of the listenership and went, maybe everyone hates it. So if you're a fan of this bit, you don't need to be a fan, you just need to be not moved to smash your MP3 player. This is a stupid code. Just tweet me the word horse, H-O-R-S-E, !! And if you like, you can put hashtag horse on it as well, just to let me know so I can do some sort of brief market research. As this is based on a game that me and my partner play. Whenever you see a horse in a field, you point at it and you shout, horse! So let's have a quick game of horse. Ready? And you don't, for this game, you don't need to have seen it. You just need to listen to this point and not loathe it. I'll set the bar at not loathe. Okay? At ComComPod. Horse!
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.